This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Kayla, and thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. American motivational writer William Arthur Ward once wrote that if you can imagine it, you can achieve it. And if you can dream it, you can become it. How many times have we heard that? Do you agree? Surely there must be some truth to it. Are some things perhaps outside of that statement? Let's look at something bigger. What about peace in the Middle East? If you could imagine it, and if you can dream it, can you have it? I decided to call someone who's both imaginative and very knowledgeable about events in the Middle East. Charles Lichtman, also known as Chuck Lichtman, is an expert in Middle East affairs and issues regarding terrorism. His newest novel is an action-packed spy thriller. It's called The Sword of David, and it's going to be available in the United States from September the 7th of this year, so that's actually next week. He has twice been recognized as Lawyer of the Year. He's founded a national voter protection program in the United States, and he's an avid photographer and pianist. He lives in South Florida with his wife and two dogs. Chuck joins me right now. Chuck, based on the research and your expertise in the Middle East and terrorism, can you imagine peace in the Middle East?
First, let me thank you for having me on the show and your listeners. And I hear you have a great show with a big following. So thank you. The Sword of David is set in what we'll call typical times in the Middle East, where there is always tension and that there is violence that pops up when you least expect it. And of course, nobody ever hopes or wants there to be the violence. So the story is set in a situation where it actually begins. The prologue begins in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple and explains what happens to the Ark of the Covenant and the Ten Commandments. It jumps to modern day where it begins with these troubled times where there's a terrorist explosion at the wall, and that sends the hero who has just lost his cousin dying in his arms under the Temple Mount where he works as an archaeologist. And I'm allowed to share this, which is he accidentally stumbles upon the Ark of the Covenant. And that sends him on sort of a Da Vinci Code, Raiders of the Lost Ark hunt for the Ten Commandments. Along the way, it's a terrorist story, and it would take place in the times that we have right now. But the story has a positive message in it as we get towards the ending and provides a hope that things could be different in the Middle East, and particularly in Israel with the Palestinians.
I can't wait to read this book.
Well, I can't wait for you to read it.
Chuck, do you think that there ever could be peace in the Middle East?
I do. I've been to Israel in the last 20 years. I've lost track. I've been reading about the history of Israel for a very long time, and I've been studying terrorism since 1972. And I do think it's conceivable. And I can tell you basically quickly why. First is that if Yasser Arafat, the ultimate terrorist, self-proclaimed terrorist, could get to the point in the Oslo Accords where he wanted peace, well, then I think anything is possible from that perspective. Second, in my travels to Israel, I've spent a tremendous amount of time talking to Palestinians. I went into the occupied territories. I went into East Jerusalem. I spent a lot of time in the Arab quarter of the Old City, just talking to regular people. And I don't believe for a moment that the average Palestinian wants violence and wants this conflict to continue forever. I really think that they want what typical families want, which is for their families to have hope, opportunity for their kids to have a better education and the opportunity for a better job and financial well-being and good health, not what we're seeing from Hamas, which is let's just kill all the Jews and drive them into the sea. And I believe that ultimately things can change. And I also think that the world does not realize that there really are fairly good relations between Israel and a lot of the Palestinian people. So I believe it's possible.
What do you think would need to happen in order for peace to be effected?
I think that the Palestinian people have to come to a realization that Hamas is not protecting their interests, that Hamas is just on its own search and destroy mission, and that there's no benefit to the average Palestinian family in Hamas continuing to have these difficult, contentious fights with Israel every so often. I think that has to happen. And I think that there has to be a leader that will all of a sudden rise to the occasion and say, enough of this. We need to figure out a better way for our people to live. That could be somebody that's already in government right now, for all we know, that's going to look up and follow Arafat's lead, or it could be someone we haven't yet met, but it has to come from within the Palestinian people, because I'm quite certain that there are Israelis that have their own, we'll just call it mutual hatred of the terrorists. I'll call the, and I make sure I say the terrorists as opposed to the Palestinians, that at the end, people realize that you're always a lot better off if you could walk down the streets of your own town and not have to look over your shoulder about there being a terrorist attack or violence or another war.
Do you think that Israel's current leadership is better equipped and in a better position to negotiate peace with the Palestinians?
Well, right now, I think there needs to be a cooling off period that will continue for a bit. And I think that with Netanyahu gone and a new government in place, that that is a good opportunity for the world to see that Israel wants peace. I think Israel actually has always wanted peace. It's just that Netanyahu's version the last bunch of years was an eye for an eye. And I think that the new leaders recognize that it doesn't have to be that way. So I think there's that opportunity.
It's interesting because it's something that I think many Jews around the world saw, is that every time there were Netanyahu elections coming up, there would be some sort of operation. It was very interesting that after a while you could actually predict it. And I think that he lost an enormous amount of credibility because of that. What's your thought?
I'll tackle that issue from the Palestinian perspective as to what was actually going on preceding this last incursion, which is that the Palestinian Authority canceled the elections that were scheduled for both the Palestinian legislature and president. And Hamas saw that as an opportunity to instigate proceedings to raise their profile. And that's because there had been a perception that Israel was being heavy-handed in some things, and Hamas takes every opportunity it can to instigate troubles, because they know that if people, no matter where they're situated in the West Bank or in Gaza, feel like there's a problem that can't be solved with Israel, that Hamas says, well, the answer is violence. And that's how Hamas has operated practically since its inception. It's really their lifeblood. That's what happened. And it's going to be incumbent on the Palestinian Authority to reel that back in and take the problem and figure out a way to soften relations with Israel so things can get back on track.
Very interesting. I'm speaking to you from South Africa. During the apartheid years, the ANC, which is of course now our government, they were actually declared by the United States, amongst other countries, as a terrorist organization. It's only in 2008 that Nelson Mandela was removed off the terrorist watch list. Now, he was already president of South Africa at the time. Do you think that it is reasonable to compare Hamas today to the ANC during the apartheid years?
No, I don't think that's a fair comparison at all. I think what was happening in South Africa was a different situation. And Nelson Mandela was ultimately a man of peace. And I think there were a lot of different political interests and racist interests that were instigating Nelson Mandela's staying in jail for as long as he did and labeling him as a terrorist. Terrorists are out to search and destroy. That is what Hamas does. And that's different than protest. And there's a huge difference between now, I'll draw between the Palestinian Authority, which has not promulgated terrorism, and Hamas. Hamas doesn't protest. Hamas takes children and puts them in front of their soldiers. Hamas sets up their organizations their organizational structure in high-rise buildings in Gaza, where the news entities are located, knowing that they've become targets. And the ironic thing about that is that, of course, the news entities that were located in the building that the Israelis destroyed knew that Hamas operated in that building. You didn't have a scenario like that in South Africa.
No.
And ultimately, I think it's one of the reasons why things changed in South Africa.
As diaspora Jews, do you think we even should have a say in Israel's foreign politics or policies?
That's a great question. I think we all want a say. I think we all want to be heard. And if I was to do a poll, which of course I'm not going to, as to Jewish opinion on having peace or having violence, that overwhelmingly Jewish people, regardless of where they live, would strongly prefer that Israel could live in peace and continue to show the world all the great things that it has done. That being said, we're not citizens of Israel. We may provide financial support through charitable contributions, but we're not there paying taxes. And I think that we should be listened to because we do provide such support. But ultimately, we're not boots on the ground in Israel. Even, you know, a guy like me that goes there as often as I can, I don't think they're going to let me register to vote there. I'll leave it like that.
I always find it fascinating that when there's a ground incursion and when something's happening in Israel, as diaspora Jews, we kind of become the scapegoat for any anger against Israel locally in our different communities. We've seen it, and we've seen it growing from year to year. And you've got people telling Israel on Facebook, via Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms, what they should be doing. 9 times out of 10, it's people who don't have skin in the game. They don't have children who are in the army, who are possibly going to go into Gaza. It's quite interesting to see how people react to Israel. And I'm talking about not just Jews, because obviously we have very deep spiritual connections there, but even the Gentile non-Jewish population. You know, it just seems to be an area of the world that everybody focuses on. Why do you think that is?
Well, first off, it's the Holy Land, right? I mean, that's really a big theme of my novel, The Sword of David. The principal chapters, and particularly the ending, take place in Jerusalem, which have very strong ties to Islam through the Temple Mount, where two of its holiest structures are located. It's obviously critical to Judaism. It's our home. And Christianity has its founding in Jerusalem as well. You know, Jesus came down from the Mount of Olives. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is literally about 100 yards as the crow flies from the Western Wall. And when you have these three important religions that are for the most part peaceful, but not, you know, all sects of them, converging into one very small space, that creates tension. Now, notably, you've not really seen the tension between the Jews and the Christians in Israel. You see the tension between the radical fundamentalist Islamists and the Jews. The issue, I think, is really bigger in the sense that what we're really facing is this very disturbing increase in anti-Semitism worldwide. If you were to take a look at the news reports from the last 20 years, you know, 20 years ago, you were hearing about a very isolated incident here and an isolated incident there, but nothing systemic. Now you have the BDS movement and the public relations that goes with that, having people take this negative view of Israel and how it behaves and how it treats the Palestinians, which is, from my perspective, not true and a massive exaggeration of the issues. And as to the anti-Semitism itself, it's now not just spoken words, because I grew up with that as well as, you know, fighting to protect myself, but there's actual violence. There are attacks against the Jewish people worldwide every day, solely because somebody's Jewish. And we've not seen that to this degree since World War II. That's really dangerous. And now part of the other problem is that Israel is not very good at managing its public relations. They do, many of the people listening on this will remember Muhammad Ali and his famous rope-a-dope in one of his championship fights, where I think it was Larry Holmes or George Foreman, Joe Frazier, whichever one it was, continually pounded Muhammad Ali, and he took it and he took it and he took it. That was called his rope-a-dope, and then he gave it back. And that's kind of like what I see with Israel, which is they just keep taking it and taking it and taking it, and then they give back when something explodes. But they don't have a strong public relations program that is out there saying, Hamas is lying about us, BDS is lying about us, and showing the rest of the world all the good things that Israel does for the Palestinian people, as well as on an isolated basis. Just for instance, the scientific discoveries that it's had in medicine and technology. And most of the world has no clue about most of that. And I think that if they manage their public relations a little differently, they might have a different perspective as to who's telling the truth. That's a complicated problem.
You're on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Kathy Kayla. This is Community in Conversation, and I'm speaking to Charles Lichtman, also known as Chuck Lichtman, is an expert in Middle East affairs and issues regarding terrorism. He's also an author who's written a book called The Sword of David, which is going to hit shelves September the 7th this year. It sounds absolutely fantastic. I cannot wait to lose myself in the story, because who doesn't love an action-packed spy thriller? We're talking about the Middle East in general, because that is where this book, The Sword of David, is set, or where the events that kick off the whole narrative are set. Chuck, if you were the Prime Minister of Israel, what would you do tomorrow to bring about peace?
Well, I would have a special envoy, someone that the general public would not know about, have a reach out to the Palestinian Authority to begin dialogue with them about how they would view resolution of permanent peace with Israel. My belief is that the only way to get to peace, and it took me a very long time to get there, is that there should be a two-state solution. I don't think that Israel should have a role in ruling the Palestinian people any longer. I just don't see any upside in that. So getting to a two-state solution and letting the Palestinian people rule themselves completely with safe borders would be critical. I fundamentally, because of the religious implications of the Temple Mount, understand why, combined with the fact that the Palestinian people have been living in East Jerusalem for many hundreds of years, you know, actually probably, 1,000 years, that East Jerusalem is sort of their property too. And it's unfair, I think, if I want to just take off my totally Jewish hat to say, well, they should have no say. It's their home also. And nobody would like being dispossessed from their home. That causes conflict. So that would have to get resolved. And I personally wouldn't have a problem with there being a dual capital. In fact, I think actually if the goal is to attain peace and to have open communication where we would work together with the Palestinian people, that there might be some benefits to having the Palestinian capital be part of in East Jerusalem. I think a lot of people would say Chuck has lost it, but I have spent a lot of time looking at this, and I address these issues in The Sword of David. I don't want to, you know, spoil the plot, but this is something that I had contemplated as part of the book, and it's critical to the book. So those are my most basic views on it.
Do you ever look back in Jewish history to, say, the year 70 of the Common Era, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and look at it and say, actually, it was the Jews who were dispossessed of their land?
When I wrote the prologue to the book, which takes place in 70 AD, I had to go back to Josephus and read Josephus's history of what happened there. And yeah, the Romans were invaders. It had been the Jewish land, you know, King David, right? I get that. Ultimately, of course, the Jews didn't have the power and the military to defeat the Romans. Part of it, though, was our problem, that the Jews actually caused the problem, because history books, as I read it, and as I've researched after I read Josephus to make sure I understood it, was that the Romans respected the Jews. They didn't want to have a war with them. All they wanted them to do was pay a tax. And the Jews steadfastly refused to do anything that was cooperative with the Romans in paying that tax. And they instigated over and over. And I think it was General Titus that almost immediately preceding the final battle, and it was like August of 70 AD, where the temple was destroyed, kept saying, we don't want to do this to you. Just, you know, work with us to solve this problem. And the Jews refused to do it. And I think that had they behaved differently 2,000 years ago, it's impossible to say how that would have played out. But I don't think that the great second temple would have been destroyed, at least then. And instead it was, and Jerusalem was sacked, and Titus did to the Jews in Jerusalem what they had done as they marched through all sorts of parts of the world, conquering, you know, those that wouldn't play ball with them. My best speculation is that the Jews were afraid that they would be totally assimilated into the Roman culture, but that's not what it seemed the Roman Empire actually wanted to accomplish. They wanted Jerusalem to be more of a base of operations, kind of like the United States has with aircraft carriers located in various sections of the world. Not a totally dissimilar situation.
Interesting that you talk about assimilation, because here we are. I'm in South Africa, you're in Florida, and we're talking about the fear of Jews assimilating in the year 70 of the Common Era. We've not assimilated over 2,000 years. Isn't that an irony?
Yeah, I don't think we ever will, and I honestly hope we never do. I think we're a great religion. I'm proud to be Jewish. I will fight for our people tooth and nail to the end. You know, I'm not going to be a martyr blowing myself up, but I can provide intellectual support. I can provide financial support. I can do things like talking to you and helping educate people. I can mobilize people, and have, because I'm very active in what's called the Secure Community Network, which is the branch of the Jewish Federations of North America that's responsible for providing security to the Jewish people in America. And I think that, you know, we can do a lot to improve perception of Judaism, but ultimately it's going to still all come down to how people perceive Israel. Like if in the United States, all of a sudden if Israel was accepted as being, we'll call it more gentle. And I don't think that that's necessarily a fair statement. I'm just talking in hypothetical here, that maybe the anti-Semitism might drop a little bit.
So what do you think would stop anti-Semitism? And what do you think has increased it?
Well, it'll never stop. That would be just naive. It's inbred and it's passed down from generation to generation. And I don't think anything can stop it, period. And I'm going to give you an example. And I learned this with personal experience. When I was in first grade, there was a boy that came up to me one day and called me a dirty Jew. And I went home that day and I told my dad, I said, I didn't tell him. I asked him, I said, what is a dirty Jew? I was called dirty Jew in school today. And I'll take the story a bit further, but my father, who was a big, strong man, and he always had a very even disposition, went ballistic. I remember that. I remember him grabbing me by the hand, putting me in the car, driving to the front door of the man of the home of where the boy lived. It was only a couple of blocks away. The father was well known in the community. And when he answered the door, my dad literally grabbed him by the shirt and put him up against the door and said, if your kid ever says another word to mine about being a dirty Jew, I'm coming back for you, or whatever the words were that he said. You know, for me to tell you, I remember explicitly what he said back in 1962 or so wouldn't be fair, but that was the gist of it. And I give you that story because obviously the boy heard dirty Jew at home, right? And I experienced a lot of anti-Semitism from kids in high school and got beat up a ton from it. I look back and say that was actually good for me because it gave me insight into the real world. But all of these kids that were anti-Semites in high school, it's not because they were geniuses and picked up books and started reading and said, oh, these Jews are bad people. It's because they heard it at home. And that goes on all around the world, and that is not going to change. It would be naive thinking, absent us, meaning Israel or Jews or whomever, finding some unbelievable cure to every illness in the world and bringing about world peace by ourselves. And of course, that is not realistic.
There's a Jewish historian by the name of Ken Spiro, and he says, you know, hatred of Jews is completely supernatural. If you hate somebody of color, you are a racist. If you hate a Chinese person, you are a racist. If you hate a Jew, it's so supernatural and so unusual, the hatred for a Jew, that there's a special name for it. It's anti-Semitism. Hating an Arab, you're a racist. You aren't an anti-Semite. It's a very interesting phenomenon. How do you understand it, Chuck?
I've never heard that before, but it's true. I mean, if you're anti-black and if you're anti-Chinese or gay or whatever, you know, you're a racist or you're homophobic, but we do have that special label. I had never really thought about that before. And it is what it is. It's just not going away.
It's getting worse. It's no longer politically incorrect. You're on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Kathy Kaler, and this is Community in Conversation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm speaking to Charles Lichtman, also known as Chuck Lichtman. He's an expert in Middle East affairs and issues regarding terrorism. His newest novel is an action-packed spy thriller called The Sword of David. It hits the shelves in the United States on September the 7th, which means you'll probably be able to get it online or via Amazon here in South Africa until it's on our shelves. He has twice been recognized as Lawyer of the Year. I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing, Chuck.
I'm honored to have received the award. I love being a lawyer. I handle complex business litigation, but in my heart of hearts, I've always been a writer. And if somebody said, okay, you can do one or the other as of right now, frankly, I'm spending my time writing. I'm very proud of The Sword of David. I know because I just keep reading it in reviews over and over and from my friends that have looked at it that I know would be brutally honest, including my sister-in-law who likes to be brutally honest, that it's a really entertaining but thought-provoking thriller. It has these qualities to it that are very similar to The Da Vinci Code and Raiders of the Lost Ark, not because I was trying to copy them, but because it was necessary to tell the story the way I wanted to. And I think people actually have fun reading the book. That's the impression I'm getting. While at the same time saying at the end, wow, because it's a conclusion you don't see coming until it's right there in front of you.
I've never envied Alan Dershowitz, but I do now because he read your book and he gave it rave reviews.
Yes, I happen to know Alan and have worked with Alan. And Alan is brutally honest. Alan wouldn't have given me that quote unless he really believed it. And I know that he read the book. And Alan is as strong a voice for the support of Israel as anybody can be. His book, I have him up on my shelf, A Case for Israel and Defending Israel. If the average citizen or the average Jew wants to understand in plain English countless issues related to Israel, those two books are just critical to, in short order, learning a lot about Israel that you might not otherwise know.
What do you wish more people knew about Israel?
That we don't mistreat the Palestinians the way it's portrayed. I understand the impact of the news when they have cameras showing Palestinians being removed from long-standing homes in East Jerusalem. Okay? But that is not how the country typically operates. It's not how I believe most Israelis behave or how they feel. And I think they should also recognize the enormous contributions that this tiny little country with the population smaller than many of the states in the United States, the things that we accomplish every day. It's such a remarkable country. And what's so amazing about it is that what Israel has survived going back to 1948, the very day that it was declared a state, they were invaded from all corners with very few weapons and held off the Arabs. And they've won all these wars. I don't want to suggest that Jews are smarter than anybody else. I would never say that, and I don't believe it. But we do have something within us that makes us figure out how to problem solve, because they took arid land that was marshy, that the Arabs didn't even want. The Palestinians couldn't wait to sell a lot of that property to the Jews in the 1930s and the 1940s, and have turned it into farmland and industrial property, and they've just done amazing things. It's unprecedented from my perspective in all of history.
What do you wish more people knew about Jews?
Pretty much the same thing. I think that we are actually, in terms of religion, a more moderate or even liberal religion in our views of how we treat each other and how we treat people, that we don't have provisions in the Old Testament that instigate the Jewish people to violence. We don't have leaders as Jews that instigate people into violence, except for the occasional radical that, you know, like Meir Kahane. But even Kahane was like, he didn't want to have violence, but he wasn't going to stand up and just take it. I understand that. I grew up with that. You know, we're good people. I mean, think about Yom Kippur, the day of repentance, where we go to a day of atonement, where we go in and we repent for the things that we did in the past year so that we can contemplate what can we do in the next year to be better. I don't know if there's any other religion that does that. I know there's maybe some parts of Hinduism and that perhaps they think about always the positive, and some Chinese religions as well, but it's a unique, really good religion.
So it's interesting about Yom Kippur, which of course is coming up in a few weeks' time. Yom Kippur is the sins that we commit against God. Because the sins that we commit against man, we have to ask for forgiveness, which I think is very profound. Because when you have to ask somebody face to face for forgiveness and to make peace with somebody, you have to acknowledge your own wrong to do that. And it takes an enormous amount of courage. You know, the conversation about whether we could have peace in the Middle East, because it is going to take courage on both sides. And clearly, up until this point, there hasn't been the political will to do that.
I'm hoping that this last episode in the Middle East, you know, with the Palestinians, particularly in Hamas, and the change in the government, particularly, will lead to, it's not going to happen overnight. It can't happen overnight, but will lead to a mindset where both sides can sit at the table and you talk about forgiveness. And if you go back and you look at the Oslo Accords, you know, actually it was Rabin who at first said he did not want to have a handshake, much less a hug, with Yasser Arafat. And I don't know how much of the world actually grasps that Arafat, when it came down to it, there's some historical fact that maybe he was kind of receding a little bit at the end. But when he heard Rabin had died, you know, the report generally was that he cried. That's a remarkable event to think that Yasser Arafat, who had envisioned destroying Israel, finally got to the peace table. And when his adversary that became his friend died, he cried. That's a very strong statement about what was really happening inside Arafat's brain. If Arafat can change, then I think almost anybody over there can. Now, right now, the leaders of Hamas, they love their power and they love what they do, and they think instigating with Israel makes them heroes. That's why we go back to earlier in our conversation where it's going to take a transitional leader in Palestine to change that dynamic. But if you don't hope and you don't wish for peace, then I think there's something wrong with you. And I do think it's possible.
Accept in the past that Palestinian mothers love their children as much as Israeli mothers do. And that's something to remember, that we're not that different.
We're almost a friend in Israel. His name is Kaider Baidoun. Baidoun is maybe the best known antiquities dealer in Israel. He's located in the Arab quarter, and of course he's Muslim. And I had the opportunity to spend significant time with him and to get to know his son, who's my age. Kaider's probably mid-70s. And I've seen their family dynamic. I've heard how his family conducts themselves. And to me, they're no different than how Jewish families behave or what I see in America, how American families behave. And I tell you, I couldn't be more fond of the Baidoons. When I go back to Israel, probably I'll spend as much time with them as anybody else that I'll see, because they're real people. They're good people. And I met a lot of people just like that in Palestine and in Israel, excuse me, they're Palestinian. So it gives me hope to see what real people are like. And, you know, unfortunately, most people, even those that go to Israel regularly, don't take the opportunity to learn about the Palestinians more.
See for yourself. Get your own information. Don't only rely on the media. We're almost out of time, Chuck, but I cannot let you go without talking about the Ark of the Covenant. Where is it?
Actually, you know, history says that it disappeared in 586 BC with Nebuchadnezzar destroying the temple. But, and I write about this, that Exodus, the book of Exodus, says in plain Hebrew, I like to say plain English, but it was written in Hebrew or Aramaic, that this is how you construct an Ark of the Covenant. So I just find it absurd to think that if Nebuchadnezzar took the Ark of the Covenant that Moses, you know, had constructed in the desert, it disappeared, that the Jews weren't going to go back to Exodus and so say, okay, here's the directions. Let's build another one. It just doesn't make any sense to me that that would be the case. So I honestly believe that logic says that another ark was built, that that ark was placed in the second temple that, you know, the Romans destroyed, and that, and I write about this in the Sword of David, and that there was a place to hide the ark. They had to protect the ark. And I wouldn't be surprised if you could have one ark, if you could have more than one ark. Why not? The Bible doesn't preclude that. It just talks about Moses having constructed the ark and then how you would do it. So I actually think that there's a couple of things happening, that there was an ark that was in the second temple. And then you can go to when the Knights Templar became a military force back around the year 1000, that they were, I mean, everybody knows the legend that has read anything about the Knights Templar. It was basically started with 12 knights. They received permission from the Pope to go to Jerusalem and to dig around the Temple Mount. And they do that for like 12 years. And then all of a sudden they go to Rome and they are rich and famous because of something they found. Well, what the hell else would it be? We know from the Ark of Titus in Rome that the Romans carted off the great menorah, right? You can see that on the face of the Ark of Titus that sits right across from the Colosseum. But to me, what else could they have found besides the actual ark that was reconstructed? What would make them so powerful and go and have the Pope embrace them as his new military order, unless it was something like the ark? That's what I surmise happened.
It's very interesting, because what makes the ark valuable to us is not what the ark is, but it's what's inside the ark. The original Ten Commandments made out of sapphire, the broken tablets, the clothes that God made for Adam and Eve, a jar of mun, we think, Moses' staff, the sapphire staff, which was passed down from Joseph.
Sounds like you read my book.
No. I'm a practicing Jew. That's what I know. And there's also, I think it's the ashes of the red heifer. So it's very interesting that, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it is the copy that the Romans carried off, and the original is somewhere under the Temple Mount and taking up no space. Because if you go back to the Hebrew text, as I'm sure you have, that from wall to wall of the Kadosh HaKodashim, you add the ark to that, that took up no space.
Yeah, well, I address that in the book. And then to make this real, I knew that as I wrote the Sword of David, I had to research everything as exhaustively as I could. And I went on research missions to London, Paris, Rome, and of course to Israel many times. And in one of my trips to Israel, a friend took me to the wall where the tunnels are, which I had been in many times, and the tunnels are important to my story, and was talking with somebody that works there as an archaeologist that he knew personally. I didn't get to go explore everything underneath the Temple Mount. You know, the average person sees the tunnels tour and that's it. But that he did take me to some places I know that people don't normally see. And what the world doesn't really understand is that you could say that the Temple Mount was like the first high-rise building, or one of the first high-rise buildings, because there's structure underneath the Temple Mount. It's not really all just dirt. There's all sorts of rooms and tunnels and streets and avenues. And if you look at a copy of what the Temple Mount looks like back from 70 AD, there's staircases that led in from different directions. So I got the distinct impression that, contrary to what the Wak, for who controls the Temple Mount, would like, that we've been digging around underneath there for a very long time to see what's going on. And we just in the last couple of months opened up a new section of the tunnel for the public to see. So, you know what? Who knows what's hidden down there, right?
100%. And maybe it's hidden in plain sight. Who knows? It'll hopefully come out in its own good time.
Well, it comes out in my book.
Well, the book comes out on the 7th of September. So thank you very, very much. Chuck Lichtman, it has been a true delight speaking to you. You are a very, very interesting man. I'm looking forward to reading your book. This interview really wasn't about your book, but in every way it was. I have no doubt that it is going to be a phenomenal, phenomenal bestseller. I wish you and your family a Chag Sameach and a Shabbat Shalom, and thank you so much.
And Chag Sameach to you, and thank you very much for this opportunity. I really enjoyed our talk. And I also enjoyed, and thank you for the plug for the Sword of David.
A year ago, we all witnessed the Abraham Accords. Seeing the warm peace that Israel now enjoys with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, did you ever think that you would see it in your lifetime? I certainly didn't. Maybe, just maybe, there is some truth behind dreams becoming reality. While I will never become a fighter pilot, Chai FM was started from a dream. I know all about that, but that's another conversation. I wish you and yours a Shana Tova Umetuka, a sweet, joyous new year filled with God's greatest blessings. I wish you a Shabbat Shalom.
This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.